Hey everybody, happy afternoon, Thursday afternoon.
Warm.
What?
She's taping.
Oh, hi. Yeah. Thanks for reminding me. This is Ben Stewart, and we're here. It's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's cold in the summer. And we're gonna take a look at John 12, 20 through 25. So Gospel of John, chapter 12. And we're going to use this text. It's one of the, it's a central Christian image, this business of life out of death. And so today we're going to take a look at this text, ask a few questions about it, and then I want to share some voices from the research I've been doing and see if they might be illustrations of what this text is asking us to imagine. Okay? So let me read here. This, when I pressed print on the printer today for my 8.5 by 11, this is what came out.
Little scrolls at the top.
Yeah, exactly.
John 12.
John 12, Gospel of John, chapter 12. Now among those who went up to worship at the festival were some Greeks. They came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and said to him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." Philip went and told Andrew, and then Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Humanity to be glorified. Very truly I tell you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains just a single grain. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Those who love their life lose it, and those who hate their life in this world will keep it for eternal life." All right. I'm going to ask you, just as a kind of starter, what does this mean to you? Especially this business of loving your life and losing it, hating your life and keeping it. Maybe it's a big question mark.
I think anytime you try to hang on to something, or which I think is a way of trying to control something, you don't really have anything, and it's in the letting go that it comes to life.
Yeah. So there's a spiritual wisdom in this business of like trying to control something, trying to keep it, sometimes out of a sense of security. We learn that there's life in letting it go.
Yeah. So I have an example that I ran into when I worked in my first job that I was working at. I worked for the utility for Los Angeles. And so it's a public utility, and we used to kind of joke about it being the warm cocoon. You know, you got a job there, and it was next to impossible to get fired, right? You could just, for the most part, people worked hard. But I encountered people who absolutely hated their job. They, every day they came to work dreading their job, and they didn't like it, you know. And I remember talking to one person, and I talked to a few about this, and said, "Well, why don't you quit?" And they're like, "Well, I only have 7 more years till I retire, or I only have 15 more years. Huh. I can make it." Huh. And I remember walking away, just like, "You're losing your life. You know, you're hanging on to this so tight. You're so afraid of what's out there that you're going to get the end of it. You're going to go, why?"
Yeah. Yeah. So clinging to a kind of security, even for years, right?
For years. They hate it, you know, every day, you know, it's like, so you're going to go through this for 7 more years or 15 more years or whatever it is, just so that you can retire and you're going to be so bitter and so...
Okay.
Statistics don't bear out very well that you work until you retire, that people that work at the jobs that they hate, that they don't live very long after they retire despite all that.
It can literally be a way of losing your life.
Yeah. So whenever I hear that, I think of that example as Here's someone that is clinging to something that had really no meaning, but they made it, and they're losing their life.
Yeah.
It's just every day there.
Yeah.
And it's exactly what they're saying. It's what you're attached to, and where's your treasure?
Yeah.
And if you're attached to kind of preserving this life, are you really going to have life? It's sort of like the questions we're asking in the class.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sounds like we'll be asking those even, especially today.
Yeah.
Are there ways that this kind of text can be abused, or have you seen it abused? This approach, lose your life in order to give it, in order to gain it. What would that look like? Sorry?
Suicide bombers or martyrs or...
Okay, yeah.
Well, I've even seen it in Christian workers who work so hard that they basically have no relationship with family. I mean, there's no balance.
Yeah.
They don't know if they're loved by God. It's a works thing. It's sort of like, this is what I'm driven to do. And there's not balance.
Yeah, there's a kind of sense of, I'm only being faithful to God when my life is miserable.
Right. Yeah.
Right. Because it's all about pouring out for others.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Many congregations lay that guilt upon their pastor.
Yeah.
The pastor, right. You should be like Jesus. Yeah, always on call, never your own needs, always, yeah. Paul, I saw a hand heading up there. Was this?
It's just the radicalism that I love about the whole set of verses. And I think of an environmental example. Those of us who pull the weeds out of our garden, and I'm not out of our garden, out of our lawn, and kill the dandelions, you know, pull them out, and we don't want to put chemicals on the lawn. So I did just sit on my butt and kind of squirt along and pull up all the bad weeds. But by doing that, I'm affirming that value, that a green lawn really matters. And what I really ought to do is learn to love dandelions. So when I cling to this value and I'm losing, I haven't lost my life, but I'm killing ultimately the environment. By the way, because I'm perpetuating this value that we got to have green lawns, we have to have green golf courses, and we can drive Colorado out of the Colorado River to water the. Does that make sense? To water the.
Yeah, but thank you for not spraying it.
You know, it's a start.
You're building your wall.
Yeah, it's just like that poem.
A tiny thing on that, actually, instead of killing your dandelions, you can just eat them.
Eat them.
They're
right.
Full of nutrients. Yes. They're the most nutrient rich thing in your grass, you know. Huh.
We are
I don't need the worms.
And the bees love them too.
Should we not paint our houses then too? And there are some things that have aesthetic value.
Well, the paint is protecting your house. The green lawn is doing uneven. How is that benefiting the longevity of you having a place to live, which I think in 50 to 75 years, when we realize that we're not building houses that are built to actually last multi-generations, we're going to have problems, but that's another issue.
Yeah. Let me say a few things about this text before I try to show how some of these participants in the natural burial movement, I think this kind of text is resonating really richly in their experience. The text that we read today, it's a couple of Greeks who want to see Jesus, right? And Jesus says, the strange thing about a seed being hidden in the ground and dying to bear much fruit. If you want to see Jesus, he's basically saying, this is where to look. Look in the deep ground for something dying. It's going to bear much fruit. There's an interesting parallel between this text, right? So it's these Greeks from outside of Israel, the people of Israel, who are coming to Jesus, and they want to see him. And we get Philip and Andrew kind of doing this little shuttle diplomacy. It's very much a parallel with the first chapter of John when Jesus sees them. And and he's introducing himself to show himself to them. And there he says, you think you've seen amazing things now. You're going to see what he really builds this up. Jesus answered, do you believe because I told you that I saw you under the fig tree? Fig tree there. You will see greater things than these. And he said to him, "Very truly I tell you, you will see the heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending upon the Son of Man." So at the beginning of the gospel, there's this vision of, you're going to see the heavens opened. You're going to see a connection between heaven and earth. And by this part of the gospel, we're getting to a deeper kind of realism about what this great tree and this connection between heaven and earth looks like, and it involves the death of Jesus. You could do a riff on this, that these are now Greeks. And when Jesus says you are going to lose your life, he says you're going to lose your psuche, which in Greek philosophy is the soul, which is this kind of disembodied idea, especially in Platonic literature, and would have been very familiar to the hearers of John's gospel. So those who love their soul, they lose it. And to my ear, I usually hear like somebody else is going to come and crush it, but it actually means here like you will actively destroy it. You will ruin it yourself. And those who push away their soul in this world, this kind of political cosmos, you will keep it, and the word here is the same word for like a treasury. You'll keep it, and the NRSV says for eternal life, but that same word can mean into eternal life, not a sense that it's some separate thing that you'll hold on to and unlock later, but the life you feel you experience now will be carried into abundance and to eternity, into the ages. So the Greeks a little, I think through, you know, we've had through probably American evangelicalism kind of rigid ways of hearing this text, but there's much more mysterious stuff going on here. What does it mean to have a life that endures and to carry it into, to keep it like a treasure among us? The folks in this natural burial movement have some ideas about that. So I'm gonna show you some of the wonky research I've done that has a lot of the voices from this. And let's see if this can be some particular examples of what it looks like to have a life that lasts, that endures into eternal life. So I'm going to give you kind of four images of themes that people have talked about in the natural burial movement as I've talked to them about how this makes sense to them. And the first is this image that comes up over and over again of tucking in. And I'm going to unfold this a little bit. And it has to do with the sense we got from Becky's right yesterday that there's a really strong emphasis on embodiment in the natural burial movement, that we participate in caring for bodies, right? So many participants are aware that the way that they're caring for bodies gets kind of conceptually blended with caring for the land. So they're caring for bodies in a kind of hands-on way, and they're also caring for the land. And they often think of it really in kind of motherly or fatherly ways about we're going to care for this body here, we're going to care for the land. It even extends to the making of burial vessels. So I'm going to show you kind of a short, I think it's like 3 or 4 minute clip called The Coffin Maker. And it's part of a series of little short videos on different vocations. Okay, so I'm going to plug in our sound here. Maybe kick off these lights. This guy is actually on Vashon Island.
Go. The first coffin I ever built was for my child when my wife had a miscarriage. It took me a while to figure out how to make the panels wide and make them pretty. Such a personal thing to have your hands on there and to really be working with it. Coffin making seems to have really begun with furniture makers. Metal is a pretty recent innovation, and apparently now we use enough metal every year in our coffins to rebuild the Golden Gate Bridge buried in the ground. To build an entire casket takes me about 25 hours. Mostly what I do is sand. I feel like I sand, and I sand, and I sand. I never feel like it's finished. But then I guess that's kind of a fit thing, because that's probably how we feel at the end of our lives, too. I think one of the most important aspects of the coffin is that it can be carried. And I think we're meant to carry each other. And I think carrying someone you love and committing them is very important for us. And when we deal with death, we want to know that we have played a part and that we have shouldered our burden. So, if we make it too convenient, then we're depriving ourselves of a chance to get stronger so that we can carry on. When I'm out here by myself early in the morning or in the middle of the night or something like that, I can get a sense of how work is love made visible. You know, the Benedictine monks say, work and pray. And I guess those things kind of bleed together for me. So it's not that I have some words in my head. It's more just a state of love and becoming a small part of a bigger picture that I don't fully understand. I'm building something for someone that people tend to think is a destination. People think that the grave is the end. And I'm trying to illuminate that, no, it's a doorway.
Two phrases in there, I think we're meant to carry each other, right?
Yeah,
this, it's a sense of loving care. In the act even of the making of the coffin, and that this kind of work, the work of our hands, can be an embodiment of love. I'm going to turn these lights back on.
Was that a trailer, or?
That's just, it's actually, you can find it on Vimeo if you search it out. It's from a series, I forget who did it. Maybe it was a public TV thing where they just did different vocations, just these little clips on.
And so that's the whole thing?
Mm-hmm. That's it. Yeah. So there's one. There's one way of kind of this, even from the point of view of coffin making, this way of tucking in a body, of caring for it. Many of the practitioners that I've talked to will talk about going to these natural burial grounds and trying out a place. Couples will sometimes bring a picnic blanket and say, what do you think about this? Let's lay down here and check out the view. Oh, let's move our feet this way. And which is, well, they'll also often talk about in a kind of conventional American cemetery, you don't get to choose where your head and your feet go, but here you do, and this tree, and this rock, this view, people choose, and sometimes they're choosing it for loved ones who died quickly. And even in that, people describe this as a sense of caring for them, tucking them into the earth, into God, in their final moments. So I'm going to read a few quotes from people. Here's a woman who had a terminal illness and who visited a site, she uses the image of choosing a home. I just know it's still the place for me. You know, when you go somewhere and you just know, like when you go to look at a house or somewhere and you just know that is the house. You just get those first few seconds. I've never had it before. You know how it's been a trauma the last 7 months coming to terms with what's happening. But I actually know where I'm going to be at peace. I'm going to be resting. And it's beautiful and it's natural and it's just tranquil. I think I mentioned this very briefly. Oops, come back over here. In this place, these little glades at Barton Glebe in the UK, and the burial manager there makes an observation about the way people were choosing plots. I'm going to read what he says. The smaller glades, they will shadow over earlier, like when these little trees grow up, which might appeal to some people. I wanted something organic in shape as they're planning this. And another of those learning experiences that emerged after the fact is that people like their loved ones to be buried in the little niches, the little bays and alcoves that have been created by the wavy edge of the woodland. We hadn't anticipated that, but again, there's just this feeling of comfort and nestling into the wood. Those have been really popular, so we've exaggerated that in the second phase is planting more than we have done in the first one. Because remember, this place, this is totally deforested, so they're able to kind of design the plantings. But people want to tuck their loved ones into these little niches and glades. We're in a kind of protected area. I understand evolutionarily, was that what you're going to say?
It looks like a campground.
Yeah, it does there, right. But that humans evolutionarily like that place between woods and open spaces. So we can kind of see what's around us, but also be close to the biodiversity of the forest. Let's see what I want to ask for you. I just mentioned this, that Jewish practices are recovering more and more this sense of loving care and tucking in. And this, in this article from the New York Times, this rabbi actually is speaking very much in these tucking in terms. She says, what we do with the body at the end of life is very much like what we do with it when a child is born. We wash it carefully, we wrap it in clean swaddling, and we watch it around the clock. So for many of these participants, this sense of tucking into the body is like tucking into the earth. One minister who said she actually didn't was kind of put off by how unfamiliar much of the natural burial practices were, she then said, when we actually put the coffin into the ground, she said it was surprisingly powerful because they were actually doing it, gently laying a body into the ground. Here's one that's ready, and it references two different quotes that I'm going to talk about. At the invitation of the burial ground manager, participants took pine boughs and placed them on the casket in the grave. And this is what that minister said. There was something about those pine boughs that felt like she was being tucked in. It was gentle. The family was very emotional as they did it. Just imagine that, with a pine coffin down in the ground, tossing in these pine boughs. It almost felt like arms that were holding her, like it was reclaiming her, the sense of her being tucked in. And then many participants and observers describe people lingering at natural burials. They tend to stay until the grave is completely covered again with dirt, with the participants often contributing all or most of the shoveling of the dirt. One mother who buried her husband that I interviewed on what she described as a very cold winter day described how her kids did not want to leave until it was all done. We were there for the whole thing, putting the dirt back on. One author from the UK, Hannah Rumble, talks about the origins of those words, rest in peace. You know, the prayer that they rest in peace actually comes from the Protestant critique of Catholicism with the idea of purgatory, that somebody might be in purgatory having all their sins purged away. And Protestants began to say, no, let them rest in peace, not in a kind of purgation fire. But she points out that while it has this origin, it also has a kind of affinity for a sleeping place for the dead that's located in nature amongst flowers and birds, where one can lie in this land forever in a natural woodland setting. And then I often found, too, that people would have this sense of care for the land as an extension of their care for their loved ones. So just little acts of kind of cleaning things up. I'll show a few quotes that are actually kind of funny later on about this. One woman said she found it easier to kind of talk to her deceased husband as she tended to what she called his garden there above his gravesite. So this is one set of images then, this idea that we are tucking someone into the earth and caring for them, right, physically. Another image, a kind of wider, wilder, mystic communion, right, that brings us to life in the face of death. Right? So One minister active in the natural burial movement has, in fact, a kind of prominent one, has repeatedly described a hawk that appeared at a burial to which the participants at this burial were attributing special significance. He said, at that moment, when we put the body into the grave, there was a gasp. And the people, we all looked up, and there was a hawk, a 3-foot raptor with 3-foot wingspan, a big old hawk, just circling right above the grave, and it just circled right into the heavens. Has a different resonance this week here at Holden with our hawk on the trail, right? But you can imagine if you hadn't been attacked on the 10-mile trail, you might just purely be brought to wonder at this moment. I was at a natural burial in which it was a traumatic one, and we had just covered the grave, the mother kind of still heaving sobs for her child, and a family of deer came over a rise and just kind of stood there at attention watching us and then walked into the woods. And I think all of us had this kind of heightened sense of creaturely connection to these, as if they were in some ways giving us God's blessing at this moment and prayers for healing and wholeness. It gets maybe less immediately poetic. Another woman who visits her husband's grave frequently sees a toad there. And she says, it makes it feel special that something's made this grave their home. And she says, sometimes I cut the grass down on the grave if it's smothering things. And sometimes I plant a few new things if they're not doing very well. I used to cut Victor's hair. So sometimes I think it's like cutting his hair. Kind of trim up. A couple who had planted a tree over their son's grave imagined the tree offering an ongoing connection to their son. They said, eventually when the roots stretch down that far, its fruits and flowers will contain some of our son's essence. And then a burial ground manager, reports that visitors to the burial ground frequently identify wildlife with the deceased. He says, in summer, you'll get a dragonfly just flip past and, oh, that's my wife, or that was my daughter. A woman who returns often to her husband's grave reflected on how her spirituality has shifted over time toward a greater appreciation of the shifting patterns of the season and the landscape. And this is what we found in a lot of places. The patterns of the season become really spiritualized in kind of beautiful ways, much like our liturgical year. She said this, so there's something that speaks very much of life and death and nature, you know, and that's really rather lovely. It can be really bleak in there in wintertime, but that's okay, I think. It's the seasons. It really reflects the seasons. For the first 2.5 years, which is her deceased husband, he was there. I needed to do something. I wanted to make a garden in memory of him, which is why it was such a shock when I went there last November and it was covered with all these bramble things. And I thought, well, that's not what I wanted. But I think my views are gradually changing so that I can see that the seasons are part of life and death. And they're illustrated at this burial ground in a beautiful way. And I don't think I have to do any more. I'm glad I did what I did, which is kind of gardening. But I don't have to try to create something myself because the place itself does that. So people who are planting their loved ones in these natural burial grounds are having an increased appreciation for the spirituality of seasons. And it's even allowing them to get their hands off manipulating the ground and come to learn from the land cycles itself and see the cycles of life and death. And in Christian circles, we would join them to texts like this John 12 text, that life comes out of death, right? And we see it every Easter, every springtime, and even in the promise of it, every November. I've got other examples, beautiful ones of a family who's wanted to scatter their son's ashes at the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. He died after a kind of tragic disease. And they thought that they were going to go in and swim around to find the place where they wanted to scatter his ashes. But then they said they're kayaking and a great sea turtle lifted its head up, looked at them, and they said, this is the place. And so they scattered the ashes and then they went into the water later and the sea turtle hung around there. And they said that was the sea turtle. Ordinarily, it'd be like, oh, look, there's a neat sea turtle. But because of the setting of a natural burial, the natural disposition of these ashes, they were much more opened to a kind of communion with nature, with these fellow creatures, which we usually think it's only saints like St. Francis that have an openness to this, that have an ability to get this. But people in natural, kind of regular people in natural burials are open to this wonder of our creaturely communion. Another thing that often happens in these natural burial grounds is, you know, usually when you go to a conventional American cemetery, you're going to see that things, people have brought things from their homes to place on the grave, right? Plastic flowers or flowers from the florist, or maybe a flag, or sometimes in like a liquor bottle or something that's going to, some memento there.
My sister brought a birthday cake for her little girl.
Yeah.
She would have been three.
Yeah. Yeah, so things that come from our domestic environment go out to the grave. The interesting thing in the natural burial movement, often people will bring things from the grave home. A mother that I talked to, a young mother, told me about her sons, who for a year she didn't even realize it, that they'd been gathering a stone here, a pine cone, a leaf from their father's grave, and had made kind of a shrine at home. And that was their way of remembering their dad, was all these beautiful things from the natural world that they could bring home. That's a really, it's an interesting, different kind of death spirituality, all these signs of natural, abundant life. And I think it does, it's not immediately Christian, but it has a kind of resonance with these texts that I think we're being invited into. All right, so next category. The body as gift. So let me just read some of this kind of wonky analytical stuff, and then I'll take you to the juicier quotes. The preservation of ecological habitat through conservation burial means that the bodies of the deceased, actively contribute to the ecological flourishing of the land in a few ways. By making space for many creatures to live, through the burial fees that pay for land preservation, by foregoing chemical and landfilling processes, and through the contribution of physical nutrients for growth via the decomposing body. So the final act of life then becomes a gift to the ongoing flourishing of the earth, not holding on to these bodies, not clinging tight, but letting go becomes a way of life. This spirituality of gift-giving can be part of the planning for the burial before death, as well as an ongoing spirituality for the bereaved. So I think this is interesting. The body in natural burial is at the center of the death event, not only in its giving to future generations. So usually at a death, right, you're going to have maybe the lawyer is going to read the will somewhere with the family. And the kind of legacy of the gift giving is a kind of legal document and bank accounts and an estate. But at least in part in natural burial, the gift stays centered in the body and in the land, which is a very different sense. The very body that's been a gift all through life continues to be a gift that's given to the earth. Let me see.
You see this with trees in the forest, you know, the big one dies and all the babies come out of it and they're stuff.
So you may know the author Edward Abbey, environmental activist, has kind of a gruff description of his own burial. Has a sense of that giftedness in his own inimical voice. Here it is. So here's what he wrote about his own death. After the moment of death, we should get the hell out of the way, with our bodies decently planted in the earth to nourish other forms of life, weeds, flowers, shrubs, trees, which support other forms of life, which support the ongoing human pageant, the lives of our children. That seems good enough to me. And in fact, that's the way Edward Abbey was buried, out in the desert. Let me see, we'll get some other voices in here. People talk about, people who've lived with the focus of their life being on the ongoing life of the world, that they're in death even then. It's a logical continuity with their life, that they're contributing to the ongoing life of the world. And it gives them, even in their planning for death, a sense of joy and excitement. People talk about being filled with life as they think about their death. It's interesting to think about, kind of in Christian terms. What would it mean for a whole movement of people to be filled with joy and excitement, and even a kind of sense of mission as they think about their own death? Not wanting to hasten it, right? Okay. So 1%, a woman who was pre-registered for a natural burial and her husband is already buried there, she imagines the quote, what she called the creation that will come of their death and burial. She said, I'll be happy when I go if there's a nice piece of woodland there, which people will say, okay, so they were part and parcel of the creation of that, right? Is this also her? Yeah. Oh, this is a different person. My body will feed the tree. The tree will grow, provide habitats for animals, and help the planet. How great is that? Now, I mentioned this one. I love this guy. You can kind of hear a British accent to this guy. But it's a guy who, it explains that he'd been kind of on welfare his whole life, on disability, and his body had been disabled. And he was imagining the pure gift of his body in death. This is what he said. It's kind of cute, too, the way he said it. I'm happy about it, you know? I've been out there to the burial ground and I've seen where I'm going to go. It appealed to me because I felt I was putting something back to the earth, really. Do you know what I mean? Because all my life, because I've been poorly, I've been on invalidity benefit because my body hasn't done what I wanted it to do. So I had to give up work early and I felt like a parasite sometimes, you know, a drain on the state. But I feel at least I can put something back, he's laughing here. Back to the badgers. I like to think I'll have badgers running around me. Because, you know, as you can see, I'm mad about badgers. Right? So, imagining your own role in providing habitats for creatures that you love. One place in the United States, this place, the Green Springs Natural Cemetery, actually one of the founders was the grandson of Aldo Leopold. And one of the first persons to be buried, who's Aldo Leopold, you know, famous Sand County Almanac and developer of the land ethic law, forestry professor at Yale. And this place.
It says everybody's welcome.
What's that?
It's saying no trespassing. It says welcome.
Welcome, right. Hikers, picnickers, skiers, and birders, welcome. Hunting, trapping, motor vehicles, artifact, and plant collecting, strictly prohibited. But this place, the Green Springs, was intentionally located between two flourishing woodlands that didn't have a connecting piece between them. So they were getting blocked by, you know, pretty heavily used farm. Green Springs took up residence and then was able to join thousands of acres to make it one contiguous set there. Two places that were both 4,000 acres now joined.
So where is this located?
This is in New York State. And I forget his first name. Can't remember it. But the Leopold grandson is now, in fact, buried there. details for later. Okay, so one more. Leaves for healing. This motif of healing frequently appears in the spirituality of participants in natural burial. And if you think about that, in some ways it seems natural that we would talk about healing, but think about it, most of our regular cemeteries, we don't use the language of healing very often, but it's just almost ubiquitous in the language of natural burial. Some of the things, how do people phrase it? The earth is being healed through conservation burial. The place of burial is described as healing for those who come to mourn and remember their loved ones. The physically engaged caretaking involved in the process, like we practiced with Becky yesterday, that's described as therapeutic and healing. The changing seasons and their cycle of life and death are sometimes received as aesthetic invitations into a spirituality that seeks healing in due season. It doesn't have to come right now. It will come around with the seasons. Right? And perhaps most profoundly, the most traumatic deaths are sometimes experienced as reframed or even healed by death practices on a flourishing natural landscape. I mentioned this on the first day. Traumatic deaths and early deaths are disproportionately represented in natural burial grounds. So people who die in car accidents or children who die of a terminal illness too young are more often than others brought to these grounds, and people speak about the way that this is part of their healing process, to kind of take this death that seems unnatural and untimely and put it in the context of this flourishing natural life. Right, join it to that. A woman who lives near one of these natural woodlands She says, you can touch and hear and feel. It's the leaves and the trunks and the shapes of the fact that everything is alive and lush and green. And to me, that's very spiritual. If you're anxious or worried about something, to go for a walk in a wood is very therapeutic because of that life and the energy that the wood gives off, the light, the colors, the smells, the noises. Here's one woman speaking kind of raw about the death of her 22-year-old son and her own sense of healing related to this natural place. My son was just 22 years. He loved life. I cried and screamed after the funeral that I didn't want to hug a fucking tree. I felt very angry, and I still do. But I do like seeing the tree taller now and representing beauty and life. And I hope when his daughter, who's now 6 years old, one day stands beside the thick trunk of this tree, she will receive some pleasure and comfort from touching it. Right? So not hiding a kind of tragic and painful raw death, but rightly this tree that's planted when this guy dies becomes a sign of God's ongoing life in this place that can be a testimony even to a daughter left behind.
Remember that book by Shel Silverstein, The Giving Tree?
The Giving Tree.
They could have got one more chapter and made a coffin out of it, or a box yes. out of the stone.
Yeah.
You know, for his ashes.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking, when you think about the unnatural deaths that surprises the children, it's different than those of us who are now having a chance to think about, oh, yes, we want this. So how does it happen that grieving, heavily grieving families who didn't expect a death would even think to do this?
Sometimes they've heard of it in advance. Sometimes it's ashes, so there's a little more time to take. Sometimes it's terminal illnesses, so they know for a year that the cancer is advancing. Yeah. All right, I just realized how fast our time is going. Don't want to say anymore. The other thing that I guess I would mention about these places, so I'm just a few images of, you can kind of see this as like, even in the face of difficult death, these are places of healing, of restoring the land and healing our spirits even as we do this. Many of these places actually though become places of community. There's a place over in Europe that every Christmas invites everybody who has some connection to this burial ground to come for a great Christmas feast. And they talk about that community being joined to the land, both in their grief and in their hope for the future life of the planet, becomes one of their most important parts of their healing, that community of human beings joined to the land. They see it as part of, many of them see it as part of God's healing, even in the face of death. Can we sing a hymn? Okay, so this is part of our tradition. I think we'll, let's have us, you guys know one hymn, so let's sing the less familiar hymn. All right, Bonnie, are you good
yeah.
with that? So you know, go back and take a look at the words of an older hymn, Now the Green Blade Rises, right? Sometimes think about these images of natural burial. See how that's already deep in the DNA of Christian theology. But this one, we're going to sing hymn 330, 330, Seed That in Earth is Dying. There's more books in here, too. Thank you, Bonnie, for playing.
So you want a little intro?
Sure, how about a little intro?
To turn into gold and
So a last word. I think this shows that the spirituality that's going on in natural burial participants, they're in some ways, we're seeing themes generated that are deep in our biblical heritage and can only be kind of added to by this set of practices. The one Christian caveat I'd put on, or one of the Christian caveats I'd put on this natural burial movement, is that there's a way in which you can look at these practices and be like, oh, they're so beautiful, so poetic. I want my burial to be the best one ever. Just beautiful, in the kind of Martha Stewart burial. And if there's anything that ever reminds us that we are not in charge of this, death intervenes. And so, you know, my family knows I've been obsessing about this stuff, and they know what I want. But I've also told them, central to the promise of the gospel, is that if it comes to the point where I die and the plans that we've made can't be done, and you got to pump me full of chemicals and put me in an SUV and bury me in a vault, the promise that we just sang, that Jesus goes deep into death to bring life out of that, I know that that promise is good for me. You have confidence in it too. If there was ever an ugly, non-Martha Stewart death, it was Jesus' death. And that death gives us confidence that we live even in the most polluted of deaths. Right? So that gospel word goes deep into deforested places, into beautiful places like this, and even into, as we'll look at tomorrow, a kind of Golgotha landfill, the promise of the cross becoming the tree of life even there. So that's a lot of talking. That's a lot of images. I hope you can see that there's great theological promise in these practices, life in the face of death. And we're going to hear more about questions of life, death, doubt, faith. Yeah? Coming next?
Yeah.
All right. 5 o'clock, don't miss it. All right.